This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can now watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. October is National Breast Cancer Awareness Month. If you didn't know this, the plethora of pink-tinged products in store aisles might clue you in. The symbol of the pink ribbon, now synonymous with the fight against breast cancer, also makes an oversized appearance every October, so much so that some refer to this month as Pinktober. Well, we're all supposed to embrace these symbols, particularly because of the horrifically high death toll of American women from breast cancer. But the so-called race for the cure has been going on for so long, with nary a cure in sight, that one might wonder where all the money that's supposedly being raised is going. One breast cancer activist who asked these questions years before anyone else did was Barbara Brenner. The organization that she headed, Breast Cancer Action, based in San Francisco, was a pioneer in popularizing the phrase, think before you pink. Brenner was a hellraiser, often a thorn in the side of establishment figures in the breast cancer industry. She was also one of the most passionate fighters for the rights of women with breast cancer. Barbara Brenner died in 2013, and a new book, So Much to be Done, is a collection of her writings edited by Barbara Schuholm, with an afterword by Anne Lamott. I'm so pleased today to welcome to the program Barbara Brenner's partner, Susie Lampert. Welcome to the show, Susie.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So Barbara Brenner, as I said, was this incredible figure, a hellraiser. First, can you tell our audience how much of a pioneer she was in thinking about this idea of breast cancer differently than others, and what her own personal struggle and relationship and living with that illness was?
Barbara was diagnosed with breast cancer for the first time in 1993. And I think one of the unforgettable moments in her life was when she asked the doctor, what kind of cancer is it? And he said, you don't need to know that. It galvanized her, it energized her. She was smart and she was curious and she was passionate even before she got breast cancer. And she had already been investigating different aspects of the breast cancer, what we might call it epidemic, but the characteristics of the disease. And so when the doctor said, you don't have to know that, she was incensed and she immediately became a breast cancer activist. But she saw breast cancer not only as a personal challenge and a personal situation, but also as an epidemic and a public health challenge. The more she looked at it, the more she understood that all the research, the war on cancer that had been going on for 20 years or more at that time, hadn't really made any progress for women with the disease. She considered that the treatment options that she faced, which are commonly called, I think the phrase was coined by Susan Love, slash burn and poison, were still the operative treatments, the state-of-the-art treatments for breast cancer at that time. That was 1993, like I said. And so gradually over the next 2 years, first by responding to an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, and then by sending a letter to the editor, and then being contacted by the people at Breast Cancer Action at the time, she joined their board. And then by the fall of 1995, she had become the first full-time executive director of Breast Cancer Action. And she changed the conversation about breast cancer from the personal narrative, the personal experience, what I did to battle breast cancer, how I survived breast cancer, to a critique of breast cancer as a social justice issue and a public health issue. She extended from the personal to the political, and as she always recognized, she stood on the shoulders of the women who had come before her, women like Audre Lorde and Sharon Batt and Ellen Leopold, and dozens of others. I'm not a breast cancer professional, so I don't know all of the names, but she took the knowledge that they had provided and carried it forward, not only in agitating for better and less toxic treatments, but also in taking a step back and looking at what had become a breast cancer industry. Barbara would have called October Breast Cancer Industry Month. And so under her leadership, Breast Cancer Action initiated the Think Before You Pink campaign, which you'll see now in October, and a Follow the Money campaign, asking questions about where all that money that's raised by pink ribbon products actually goes, and how much of it goes to companies that she called pinkwashers. That is, companies who that both put a pink ribbon on their products and make money either from the breast cancer industry or by polluting the environment and causing breast cancer.
And let's talk about that, because that was a crucial point, that the conversation even today is fixated on early detection. And there is a lot of research and information on genetic causes, but only a small percentage of women have the breast cancer gene. The majority of the women who get breast cancer, there is no known cause, and it's thought, and it's very likely that there are environmental reasons. We live in a world awash in toxins, in chemicals that we know to be cancer-causing. How did Barbara Brenner push the conversation on finding the cause, even more so than the cure?
Barbara pushed for changes in the research agenda that would be focused more on, I think I said this before, preventing breast cancer, preventing from, in the first place, preventing aggressive disease from becoming metastatic, and looking at the disparities in incidence and impact on women of different racial, social, and economic situations. But she and Breast Cancer Action propounded what they called the Puzzle Project, where they asked for research to focus first on the environmental links to cancer. I mean, really, even for people with a genetic predisposition to breast cancer, there still has to be an environmental insult that triggers a mutation in the gene that causes the cancer to opportunistically arise. So what she and others, Julia Brody at the Silent Spring Institute, has done a lot of investigation on the environmental links to breast cancer. They're very complicated. We have so many chemicals in our environment. The Environmental Working Group has also worked on this, trying to figure out which chemicals that have been approved for use and that are in common use in the United States today have some impact on whether those of us who have no genetic predisposition to cancer are actually going to get breast cancer. Right. Or other cancers.
And she was also a thorn in the side, as I said, of sort of major figures. The Susan G. Komen Foundation, whose Race for the Cure, you know, and a lot of these organizations that, you know, have pushed this cultural shift to, you know, breast cancer awareness by donning a pink ribbon, running a race, et cetera, is the best way for people to support it. How did Barbara Brenner challenge these sorts of organizations?
You know, if Barbara were sitting here today, she would say, if you're not aware of breast cancer by now, you must have been living under a rock. I would say Barbara was insulted by the ongoing publicity around breast cancer awareness, which simply made breast cancer more visible, but didn't really do anything to fight the disease. So the Komen Walk, the Avon Walk, for one thing, all the other walks, they require women to raise money, have health insurance, and clear a bunch of other hurdles before they can even participate. Second, they have a lot of administrative expenses to cover those walks. But third, and most insulting, they use the money to publicize mammograms. Once in a while, they pay for mammograms. I shouldn't say once in a while. Sometimes they pay for mammograms, but they don't pay for follow-up treatment for women who have mammograms and find the disease. So
it's just early detection, and then you're on your own. And I think that's a
right.
lot of what was missing, and a lot of what is still missing in the conversations around breast cancer, which is the broader issue of the healthcare as a right in the United States.
That's absolutely right. And I would just point out something else that Barbara would have pointed out, that early detection is not the same as prevention. You can't prevent something by detecting that it's already there. So awareness, early detection, they're not the whole story. Prevention is really where we should be focusing our efforts and our money. And
Right.
none of the pink ribbon efforts are doing that.
Right. So let's talk about the book itself, So Much to Be Done, which I love that title. I mean, those particularly women who are heroes in fighting, sometimes behind the scenes, they may not be household names, but they spend their lives devoted, usually for not much compensation, to bettering the world. Often much, often must have that phrase in their heads, there is so much to be done, too much to do, not enough time. These, I understand, are a collection of her writings. She was blogged for many years online at a website, Healthy Barbs was the name of her blog. Tell us a little bit about how this book was put together. I know you're not the editor, but of course you're intimately familiar with Barbara Brenner's writings and her work. How did the pieces that make up this book get chosen?
Well, as you know, Barbara was the executive director for Breast Cancer Action for 15 years. And during that time, Breast Cancer Action published a newsletter. I think when Barbara became the executive director, the newsletter was published about 10 times a year. And Barbara wrote a column for every edition of the newsletter for those 15 years. And so the first half of the book is a collection, a selection of columns that Barbara Schuholm assembled from the 180 or so columns that Barbara wrote during her tenure at Breast Cancer Action. The second part of the book, in 2010, Barbara was diagnosed with ALS, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease, although she hated that appellation. And she retired from Breast Cancer Action. And for the next 2.5 years, she wrote the Healthy Barbs blog. And so the second part of the book, which I believe is called Thoughts About Living and Dying, or something close to that, is a selection of her blog posts. And people who read the book can see that some of them continue her breast cancer activism. Some of them simply are thoughts about living with ALS and broadening her perspective to consider not only the challenge of living with breast cancer, but also living with an increasing disability, which robbed her of her ability to walk and to swallow, but never her ability to think, and thankfully for us, not her ability to type.
So are some of these writings never before published, or were they also all from Healthy Barbs?
I'm sorry,
Were any of the
this
writings
the
never before published before this book?
The there are some writings on the Healthy Barbs blog that do not appear in the book. And Healthy Barbs is still up online. But of course, I encourage people to read the book, which Barbara Schuholm has so elegantly shaped, and which includes both a portrait of Barbara Brenner at in the introduction in the beginning, which is a brief biography of Barbara's life and work. And then an introduction that was elegantly written by Rachel Morello Frosch, who teaches public health at the University of California at Berkeley and was for a time on the board and the chair of the board of Breast Cancer Action. And she provides context and a discussion of how important Barbara was in the breast cancer movement and how Barbara and Breast Cancer Action actually changed the discussion about breast cancer.
So we've talked
And then, of
about
course, the after.
Afterward, right, by Anne Lamott. So we've talked about the impact that her work had. I'd love to talk a little bit about her own personal story. She was raised in Baltimore. What was it that shaped her view of the world and gave her the inspiration to be the kind of activist and hellraiser that she was?
Barbara always attributed her activism to a journey that she took with her mother when she was about 10 years old to see to a rally where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was speaking. That was an unbelievably formative experience for her. Another formative influence was, I think, this of course was all before I met her, but she had an uncle who was a lawyer, and from the time she was six, she wanted to be a lawyer. And in fact, she went to law school right after college, and within a year she had left because she decided that the law had nothing to do with justice. So by that time, she was already keenly focused on justice and social justice issues. She went to public policy school for a year. That wasn't really doing it for her. We met, she moved out to California, worked for the American Civil Liberties Union in Southern California. We moved to Northern California. And finally, she went back to law school and found law jobs that were intellectually challenging and socially justifiable. And then in 1993, she got cancer.
And when did the
and
two
and pivoted.
And that's when she pivoted to the breast cancer action work?
Right. She decided that rather than arguing with people, well, Barbara always argued with people, but instead of arguing in a litigious fashion, she turned her attention to building community in the breast cancer activism world and working on behalf of women. So she argued with what I would call the breast cancer industry and others who she thought were creating obstacles or were not responsive to women's health issues.
And when did you and her meet?
We met in graduate school that year after she left law school in 1973. I guess she was in law school from 73 to 74. In 1974, she came to the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University, and that's where we met.
And so you've been with her through all of the...
We were together for 38 years until she died in 2013.
Wow. How are you hoping to keep her legacy alive? And actually, this October, then, what would she say to people who might be tempted to buy something with a pink ribbon on it or run in a race feeling like they're doing something constructive for breast cancer?
Well, the answer to the second part of your question is that she would always say, think before you walk, think before you pink, ask where the money is going. And if you can't answer the question, and how much of the money is going to something that is worthwhile, which is to say, will prevent women from getting breast cancer or will lead to better, more effective treatments. And if you can't do that, give money directly to an organization that's doing that kind of work, or walk down to your favorite breast cancer activism organization and volunteer your time. Keeping her legacy alive, I'm hoping that this book will receive widespread readership. There was also, several years ago, Samantha King wrote a book called Pink Ribbons Incorporated, and that was made into a movie by the National Film Board of Canada. And that movie is available, and Barbara has a lot of screen time talking about breast cancer and the breast cancer movement and pink washing and thinking before you pink.
So the film, the book that we're talking about, and even her website, which is still online, are really good places. Breast Cancer Action has its own website, bcaction.org. I want to thank you so much, Susie, for joining us today. And thank you for sharing your memories, your thoughts, and Barbara's legacy, a little piece of it, with us today.
Thank you very much.
My guest is Barbara Brenner's longtime partner, Susie Lampert. And we're talking about the book, which is the collection of Barbara Brenner's writing, simply called So Much to Be Done. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. We're also on Twitter at twitter.com/RUwithSonali.